Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Maxie Flats Nuke Dump, What Were They Thinking? That headline on a 2015 article by then-Courier-Journal reporter James Bruggers raised a question about the nuclear waste Superfund site near Flemingsburg and Moorhead that continues to echo in 2021.
If you go back in that period, late 50s, early 60s, there was extreme paranoia in our country about the Soviet Union. So everyone was pretty much focused on, you know, how do we protect ourselves from a nuclear attack? And so what we would look at today is very shoddy, potentially, or just, you know, like, what were they thinking types of practices. Back then, they were kind of preoccupied with what they perceived was more pressing issues, like, are we going to get nuked tomorrow?
Dr. Lyndall Ormsby is Associate Director of the Superfund Research Center at UK. Our interview with Dr. Ormsby will follow the second of a two-part interview that we begin in this edition. It's with Carolyn Payton. She's an historian at the University of Memphis, and she has researched and written an article about the history of Maxie Flats for the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. Thanks for joining us, Carolyn.
Thanks for speaking with me, Tom.
The article that I mentioned that you wrote is titled Kentucky's Atomic Graveyard, Maxie Flats and Environmental Inequity in Rural America. In the article, you note that what happened in Fleming County evolved slowly to become an important chapter in America's nuclear history. Can you give us a more detailed picture of that?
Absolutely. So as the nuclear industry expanded beyond, you know, simply defense purposes, the problem of where and how to dispose of radioactive waste, both high level, such as spent fuel from nuclear reactors, to low level waste like animal carcasses and medical scrubs exposed to radioactivity, all of that had grown considerably. And initially, from the 1940s to the 1960s, some of this radioactive waste was disposed on land, but some of it was also disposed at sea. And in fact, you even had plans to dispose of more radioactive waste along the Gulf Coast and in the Atlantic Ocean. And this prompted a lot of public opposition. And so suddenly federal officials had to find other places to bury this waste. And so the solution that they came up with, among other paths, was to privatize the burial of so-called low-level waste. And so they started searching for suitable sites, and one of those sites ended up being in Kentucky, in Fleming County, the Maxie Flats disposal site, which was owned and operated by the Nuclear Engineering Company. And so the site is licensed in 1962, and it starts operation in 1963. And for roughly about a decade, the site quietly operated, as did the other early commercial disposal sites. You know, there was muted concern at virtually all of these places, from South Carolina to Kentucky and so on. But by the time, if I could just briefly summarize it, by the time we get to the early 1970s, you started to have some fairly disturbing reports, first coming from state agencies who had been monitoring the site. And then finally, the real turning point came when the Environmental Protection Agency, or the EPA, got involved and had determined that not only did you have some radioactive isotopes or radionuclides leaving those trenches, but in fact, you had radioactive isotopes of plutonium that had migrated far beyond the site. And this was caused considerable concern about the safety of the site.
Had it reached groundwater at that point?
By the mid-1970s, they did have confirmation that, and even by maybe even as early as 1972, from monitoring the site, they had determined that radionuclide migration had absolutely reached groundwater. Now, of course, the way that the nuclear industry framed risk And, you know, both risk in terms of environmental contamination and risk to the public is quite different than the way we might conceive of it. And so even as they revealed it, they still downplayed the dangers that that might pose, despite the fact that people in that area didn't were not actually connected to a municipal water system until 1985. So they were relying upon well water.
In your research, what have you learned about what local people in the area knew or didn't know about nuclear waste in those days?
I think it's fair to characterize the community's knowledge of nuclear waste in the early days as quite limited. Nuclear engineering company, the company that operated Maxey Flats, was not forthcoming about what the site would actually store and bury. And so they presented it as a place that would store, according to people that I've interviewed, as a place that would store, you know, essentially medical waste. And so I think at the time, knowledge was fairly limited for local people, but they were still astute enough to recognize the risks in a kind of general fashion. They were aware of, you know, they had a kind of intimate knowledge of the area's geology, how much annual precipitation it received. And so even as early as 1964, there were people in the community who were concerned about the possibility that some of that waste might contaminate the groundwater in the area. So it's actually quite incredible how early on people who, you know, might not have even had a high school degree understood that there were very serious risks from the site.
Kentucky's coal industry fought the development of nuclear power. It's pretty obvious why, the competitive aspect, but you tell us that the state's political leaders, notably then-Governor Burke Combs, were at the very same time aggressively pursuing atomic-related industry. Tell us about that. How aggressive was that pursuit?
I would characterize it as fairly aggressive, and this was true of states across the American South, especially in the 1950s and 1960s. And so they, in fact, all banded together and formed an organization, the Southern Interstate Nuclear Board, which I would characterize it as a lobbying organization, which helped not only write these regulatory agreements between the Atomic Energy Commission and states, and this essentially set the template for an agreement state program where, again, Kentucky and other places like South Carolina essentially agreed to take on more of a regulatory responsibility, particularly for monitoring these disposal sites. And they viewed this as preserving, to quote people at the time, as preserving their atomic rights from federal interference. And so that's one measure, again, that Kentucky took and others did as well. But they also had mapped out, you know, at least in theory, bond financing agreements to help encourage the nuclear industry to locate to the state beyond, with the exception of nuclear power, of course. And then, I mean, one of the other measures they used to incentivize it was they required paltry tax payments per cubic foot, of waste. And so when the company first started operating, they were only paying 5 cents per cubic foot of waste. And so it's probably one of the most surprising elements of this is how little in tax revenue this Kentucky actually received from this operation. And then, of course, later on, they were on the hook for a much, much bigger bill.
Mm. Okay, let's go back to the location, to Maxey Flats. Tell us about Walter and Lueta Cox, the farming couple who sold much of the land for the nuclear waste site.
Well, much of what I learned about Walter and Lueta Cox was actually from their granddaughter, who spoke to me about their experience, at least initially in the early 1960s. And so, according to her, they both thought that it would be a good development for the community. They thought that it would be a job creator, and they were really sold on the idea that this would be a fairly safe operation. And they didn't fully understand, or it wasn't presented to them, what kinds of waste would actually be stored there. And so she described that, you know, Walter Cox was aging. He was in his 70s at that point, but she described him as no fool by any means, but he didn't really have a whole lot of experience dealing with people who were not entirely honest. And so I think they thought that they were creating opportunities in their community. And this is something that I've seen pretty consistently with rural communities that have welcomed the nuclear industry in one way or another. They often saw this as a lifeline. How can we bring more economic opportunities into communities that were in the process of disappearing? And so I think they certainly believed that they were doing something not only for themselves, but perhaps for the community more broadly.
You've described them as in-between spaces.
And I think they absolutely are. And I mean, in part because they're not so distant from metropolitan areas. They're close enough in proximity. And so in this case, they're close enough in proximity to the nuclear complex in the Ohio Valley. You know, have all of these defense installations and so forth that needed a place to store their waste. And so they're often places that we don't think about at all, especially, I think, as more and more people travel, via the interstate system and so forth. These places essentially, in many cases, disappeared, but they are these in-between spaces, I think, that we don't necessarily think about, that ultimately have harbored or housed, you know, a variety of hazardous wastes. And so I think that's an important part of the story. I'm not sure the environmental contamination that occurred at Maxey Flats would have occurred in a place that was not so isolated.
You mentioned it before, but if you could tell us more about the waste, the stuff that was buried at Maxey Flat, where did it come from?
So it came from a variety of producers. And if you look at the many documents related to what ultimately became, you know, the Superfund site of Maxey Flats, the potentially responsible parties who disposed of waste there. I mean, it's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of entities, but they ranged from utility companies, which operated nuclear power plants, to hospitals and universities. I think one of the misconceptions that people have is that radioactive waste, you know, merely comes from the nuclear industry. But of course, a number of institutions and companies produce waste that would be considered radioactive. And so it was far ranging in terms of who dumped waste at Maxey Flats. And it's really not accurate to characterize Maxey Flats as a low-level nuclear waste site, although that's what it was called at the time, because in fact, it accepted not only low-level radioactive waste, like animal carcasses that had been exposed to radiation, but it also accepted what would be characterized as special and source nuclear material, which contained radioactive isotopes of enriched uranium and plutonium, all sorts of radioactive waste that would never be buried at a commercial site today. And so it was, in fact, far more dangerous than the company and government officials had actually revealed.
So how did these wastes arrive at the site? Was it safely contained in shipment?
You know, in my research, I don't remember coming across any specific stories about accidents on the way to Maxey Flats, but this was not uncommon for commercial sites. And as concern grew in the 1970s, you would find these stories fairly often. But at least generally speaking, I can say that I would not describe the waste as it was stored, even coming to the site, as safely contained. Some of this radioactive waste was contained in nothing more than a cardboard box. Today, the standards are so much more stringent than they were, especially in the 1960s. I mean, you had a kind of loose system of regulations and standards, but there was virtually no oversight into how places were actually shipping the waste to Maxey Flats. And so it was extremely haphazard.
Well, the area that we're talking about gets a lot of rain, about up to 60 inches a year. So there's great potential for a lot of seepage. Is it known whether the plutonium, for example, leached into groundwater?
It definitely did. So it was detected in off-site water sources by Kentucky officials, and then this was later confirmed by the EPA. And again, you know, at the time, I think the risk was downplayed. And so they would have argued, and they did argue, that the level of exposure was still quite minimal. But it nonetheless revealed how little they actually knew about the safety of nuclear waste burial. And so part of what happened at Maxey Flats, particularly with the radioactive isotopes of plutonium, but also with other radionuclides that ultimately, I call them rogue radionuclides because they travel far beyond the trenches, is they started to complex with all of these other materials that were in the site, like inorganic materials, heavy metals. And if I could oversimplify it, they in some ways hitch a ride and they start to move in ways and behave in a manner that scientists didn't anticipate, and certainly officials didn't anticipate that. And so I think at first there was a lot of denial that there's simply no way that this could have occurred, but it absolutely did. And even today, you know, after decades of studying migration from sites, there's still a lot we don't know, and in terms of how to predict where it's going to go and how soon that'll happen.
University of Memphis historian Carolyn Payton. Next week, we'll have part two of our discussion about her article, Kentucky's Atomic Graveyard, Maxey Flats, and Environmental Inequity in Rural America. And we'll have a conversation with Dr. Lyndall Ormsby, Associate Director of the Superfund Basic Research Program at the University of Kentucky. WEKU is now providing daily 10-minute coronavirus updates hosted by Kelly McEvers. NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. Just look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest. Coming up after the break,
there should be some level of basic service that could be made available to every household. I don't see any other way we can ensure the education of our children and the health and safety of our seniors, or the ability of every household to be able to take part in our democratic processes during a time when we're being asked to stay at home and we can't go to public meetings of the fiscal court or the city council.
Peter Hilly, president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, on what the pandemic is revealing about the digital divide in rural Kentucky. And you may have been to a concert at Rupp Arena, but were you aware of what had happened there in the hours before the show began?
They don't want to rent the arenas for 2 days, so everything goes in 1 day. And when they put a production together, you have to be able to assemble that within a 6 or 7 hour period, because a sound check rehearsal still has to happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Rupp Technical Services Manager Bob Stoops, who along with Ticket Office Manager Jeff Bojanowski, both nearing retirement after years behind the scenes, share some of their favorite stories.
Limousine pulls up, Mick Jagger gets out, walks over to us and shook everybody's hand. That was quite memorable.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Congress is now preparing for another round of coronavirus relief, and among the ideas being debated, money for rural communities and specifically for rural broadband. Now, you might wonder why that's so important during a pandemic. Joining me is Peter Hilly, president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, or MACED, in Berea. He recently published an op-ed calling attention to what the COVID-19 pandemic is revealing about access to the Internet in eastern Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
And first, if you could, describe for us what you mean when you say there is a digital divide in eastern Kentucky.
Well, I think something that we've been aware of for a long time is that access to high-speed, high-quality broadband is not something that's readily available in all places. As we move into rural places all over America, we know that that access is not universal. And there are really two dimensions to this. And the one that we often think and talk about when we talk about rural broadband access is the infrastructure. We know that the lines don't run out to the last mile. They don't get to every house. And we also know that in rural areas, it's a lot more difficult and a lot more expensive to get that infrastructure to the last mile. Now, there have been tremendous efforts made in this regard and really significant investments, but there's more to be done. Now, we knew that before we got into this pandemic. What is different now really is a couple of things. One is that we're much more dependent, those of us who are staying healthy at home, as the governor has asked us to do, we're much more dependent upon the connectivity that can be provided by the internet. And that means to be able to work remotely, for our kids to be able to do their school assignments, to access telemedicine, which is so important right now, to be able to tune into public meetings, to carry out the basic citizen participation in democracy, to shop for essentials so that we can place our order online and then go pick it up without having to go into the store and potentially expose ourselves, or just at the end of the day to stream something to take our minds off all of this stress that's going on.
You cite a recent study by the Community Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, CEDIC, exploring the digital divide in each of Kentucky's 120 counties. And what did they find in eastern Kentucky?
Well, not surprisingly, they found that the disparity is much greater. They created an index that scores communities on a scale of 0 to 100. And, in places in eastern Kentucky in our high-poverty counties, those scores showed that the access was much less available.
What kind of difference would it make? What would it mean to the region to have that ready, affordable access to reliable, robust connection to the internet?
Well, quite simply, it is the equivalent of what President Roosevelt addressed with the rural electrification in the New Deal, or what our communities have done to get public water systems rolled out into rural areas. This is a new utility. It is something that every household should have, and that any child growing up without that access is left behind. Now, we have invested enormous resources in every community in our state to attend to the education of our children. And we spend a lot of money on school buses and the fuel for those buses and the drivers for those buses. And that's exactly the right thing to do, because we've got to be able to make sure that all of those kids can get to school, whether or not they have somebody who could drive them there. This is the modern day equivalent of the school bus. If we don't have the internet to the house, we are not allowing that child to get to school, particularly right now.
You are suggesting in the op-ed that the situation that we're in calls for new and different thinking, such as perhaps internet service providers making basic internet access available for free to everybody in the state for the duration of the state of emergency, that ideally the service providers would see this as a moment of opportunity to show some heart, do some good things, do the right thing. Is that a realistic expectation?
Well, I think it's an opportunity for for the service providers to do that. And actually, if they did it well, it could net them more paying customers in the future. I think that those of us who can afford it should still continue to pay for more bandwidth, higher speeds. But there should be some level of basic service that could be made available to every household. I don't see any other way we can ensure the education of our children and the health and safety of our seniors, or the ability of every household to be able to take part in our democratic processes during a time when we're being asked to stay at home and we can't go to public meetings of the fiscal court or the city council. So it really becomes very fundamental to all of our ability to participate with equity in our society. Now, a lot of effort has been focused for years on building the infrastructure. Congressman Rogers has exercised enormous leadership in this, and kudos to him for that. What we're in right now, though, is a state of emergency, and we can't in a few weeks or even a few months make a big difference in the penetration of infrastructure. But there are a lot of people and a lot of houses where the wires are already there, but there are people who are not connected simply because they can't afford it. So yes, my pitch to those internet providers is flip the switch, turn on the internet for every house that's got the wires to it. And if you can run more wire now, do it. But we have to be realistic about what can be done in real time about that. But where there are houses that are simply not connected because they can't afford it, let's hook them up. Let's take that extra step. Let's call it a school bus. And if the internet service providers can't afford to do that, well, then let's have the state or the federal government pitch in. Let's redirect some of the money that we've allocated for education. What we would be paying for those school buses that aren't running right now, let's spend it to make sure that those students are still able to participate on an equal playing field and get the education that they need. Let's make sure that the workers who are being asked to work remotely can connect. Let's do everything we can to try and make this equitable.
Peter, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, will begin an auction in October that will provide more than $20 billion over 10 years to finance broadband networks in unserved rural areas at up to 1 gigabit of speed. Think that's a step in the right direction?
Oh, it absolutely is. And we've already got some great examples. If you look at what People's Rural Telephone has done in Jackson County, where they have connected every phone, every home with fiber to the home, so that broadband access is available. Now, that still doesn't mean that everybody's getting it because not everybody can afford it. But there has been some great work done. And as we think about infrastructure, we've always got to think about the last mile, because a lot of the initiatives that have gone into building out more broadband into the region really just get it to the county seats. And that doesn't solve all the problems, because until everybody's got good access, then we haven't solved the problem.
And by the way, the FCC will be hosting a webinar about that auction coming up on Wednesday, May 20th, 2 to 3:30 p.m. Eastern. It's free, no registration required. We'll have the link that you'll need to join posted on the facts and information page of our website, which is esweku.org. So, Peter Hilly, what is the lesson emerging from this crisis?
Well, I think what it does is it just sort of raises the visibility of a whole lot of things that have been with us for a long time. And so when we look at a region like Eastern Kentucky, we know that we've had challenging health outcomes and we've had less access to health care. And when we have a pandemic, that becomes more important. We know that we've had significant challenges with our economy for decades, and that is going to impact our resilience as we come to a recovery from this. And so when we think about broadband, again, it just further heightens the divides and the inequities that have already been there. So it's an opportunity to look at these things, see these things. And I think as a nation right now, we have taken the opportunity in this crisis to recognize that it's actually to the benefit of the economy. It's to everyone's benefit if we take measures that help everybody. We increase the access to unemployment, if we increase the ability of businesses to receive help from the federal government, if we send payments directly to everybody in the country, right now. We are, as a nation, exploring a different sort of approach to a lot of the market-based small government ideas that have had a lot of traction. We're saying, you know what, for us to all get through this well, we've got to all get through it well.
A lot of wheels turning out there, huh?
There sure are.
Peter Hilly, president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, or MACED, based in Berea. We thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you, Tom.
Domestic violence is on the rise during the coronavirus pandemic, according to experts and advocates, but in Kentucky, fewer people are seeking out the protective resources available to them, likely due to increased isolation and fear. We have more on this from Eleanor Klibanoff with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting.
Dawn Workman says her sister, Keely Sparks, was never without a smile. Sparks was 29, from Greenup County in northeastern Kentucky. She had three kids, and Workman said she just had a spark about her.
You just never knew that she was going through what she was going through and still went on every day. Like, every day was just the best day of her life. It just amazes me.
Family members say Sparks' eight-year relationship with Gary Lee Dameron was toxic and abusive almost from the start. The couple moved to West Virginia a few years ago, and in mid-March, she was ready to leave him. She had a job and an apartment and had contacted a lawyer to help her fight for custody of her son. The day after she told him she planned to leave, police said Dameron walked into the restaurant where she worked and shot and killed her. He turned himself in and has been charged with first-degree murder. His lawyer declined to comment. Sparks is one of three women from northeastern Kentucky killed in domestic violence incidents in just a month, between mid-March and early April, according to Ann Perkins, the director at Safe Harbor Domestic Violence Shelter in Ashland.
We had probably, you know, three murders in the last 10 years, but we had three in like 1 month's time. It was like, wow, you know.
Perkins says coronavirus didn't create these abusive situations, but it may be exacerbating them. Tensions are running high, people are increasingly isolated, and families are crammed in together without much of a reprieve.
A lot of women are sitting on the couch next to a perpetrator who watches every move they make and sees every phone call they get. And that's what I've been kind of distraught over, is people not having an opportunity even look for safety or talk to anybody.
Court data shows that after Kentucky's state of emergency went into effect, applications for emergency restraining orders declined by nearly 25%. Shelters around the state say calls to their crisis lines have declined as well, and several have fewer people staying at their shelters than they typically do. Bethany House Abuse Shelter in Somerset has capacity for 21. Last weekend, Director Christy Childer said they had only two residents.
These are kind of unknown, scary times anyway, and so staying at home with the devil that you know may be easier than stepping out into a world that we're all trying, is brand new to all of us.
All of the state's 15 regional domestic violence shelters are still operating 24/7 crisis lines and offering emergency housing. All counties are still issuing protective orders, and all police departments are still responding to domestic violence calls. But law enforcement agencies are worried that that word isn't getting out there. In one emergency protective order petition in Jefferson County, a woman wrote that her abusive partner, quote, talks often about how police are not even responding to hit and runs. Do you think they'll be able to help you? LMPD Lieutenant Shannon Lauder refuted that kind of thinking on a Facebook Live video with the mayor's office in mid-April.
If you're in an abusive situation, if you don't feel safe, if abuse has occurred, please call 911. We are still coming. There are runs that LMPD has stopped responding to, but it has nothing to do with domestic violence or abuse. So please call 911 if you need us, and we will come.
That's what Dawn Workman wants people to know. There is help available for people in abusive relationships like her sister's. The news of Keely Sparks' death shocked their tight-knit community in northeastern Kentucky. The aftermath has been worse than any of them could have imagined. They had to turn people away from the funeral because of group size restrictions, and Sparks' dad couldn't come in from out of town.
It's been a hard enough time for everyone, let alone during a time of a pandemic. You can't go to church and you can't have a normal funeral. That he thought that he ripped her from us and we would never get to say our goodbyes.
But the families found ways to memorialize her. a small funeral, a balloon release, a Facebook page. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.
The National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-7233. To find a local shelter and a 24/7 crisis line, go to kcadv.org. As the Central Bank Center complex, formerly known as Lexington Center, undergoes massive updating, now seems as good a time as any to get some perspectives on what goes on behind the scenes of concerts and sporting events in that most hallowed of Kentucky venues, Rupp Arena.
Hi, I'm Bob Stoops, Technical Services Manager for Rupp Arena.
My name is Jeff Bojanowski. I'm the Box Office Manager at Rupp Arena.
Bob Stoops into his 42nd year at Rupp. It's year 36 for Jeff Bojanowski. Bob and Jeff have for decades been fly-on-the-wall witnesses to the comings and goings at the arena. They allowed me to pick their brains. So, Bob, what would you say is the craziest thing that's ever happened while you've been there?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always like this industry because the show must go on. A lot of people will probably talk about the same thing, but years ago we had a Tina Turner show with Joe Cocker as the opening act, and it was a sold-out show all the way to the rafters. And late in the afternoon, we started getting rumors that Tina hadn't arrived yet, and it's just a couple hours before showtime. And this was before cell phones. They were trying to find her and could not, you know, locate her. Nobody knew where she was, what was going on. Finally, we get a call just about an hour before showtime. The bus driver was asking where the venue was. He had taken her to Louisville instead of Lexington.
Did she make it?
She did, not in time, but she did come. That whole thing about the show must go on. Joe Cocker, what a great opening act. He agreed to play, a full hour and a half set instead of just the 45. And then we had about an hour intermission, and Tina Turner was the consummate professional. She changed into her wardrobe on the bus, and when it rolled up to the back door right here, it had barely hit the brakes, and she was out that door, heading straight to the stage, jumped on, and gave her a full two-hour set. So that show didn't go down until after midnight. I mean, so that was one of the more unusual things to have happen, and crowd stayed the whole night long. Everybody loved it, so all's well that ends well.
Put that question to Jeff Bojanowski, and he'll recall something that happened before he became box office manager. This was in 1978.
When the Rolling Stones played Rupp Arena, which was really the first big show that played in the arena. You know, there had been a lot of other shows, but that was the first really big-time show. And since I worked for the promoters, I was a production assistant, so I took care of the dressing rooms and put all the food and drinks and did all the running and got breakfast and lunch meals prepared. And when the Stones came into the back of the building, there were, I guess, five or six people. I was one of those five or six that were just kind of standing around talking in the backstage area. Limousine pulls up. Mick Jagger gets out, walks over to us, and shook everybody's hand. And that was quite memorable to say that, you know, that I was able to shake hands with Mick.
So much has changed since those days. Tech Chief Bob Stoops.
You know, it's one of the things about the industry that maybe a lot of people don't appreciate is when a show goes out, they are generally going to be playing one day after another. And from a cost point of view, they don't want to rent the arenas for 2 days, so everything goes in one day. And when they put a production together You have to be able to assemble that within a 6 or 7 hour period, because a sound check rehearsal still has to happen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And you also want to have that little bit extra time in case there are problems, that you have the show ready to go. So as technology has developed over the years, specifically for the entertainment industry, they've gotten to the point now where you can bring in 28 semis of equipment and maybe hire 120 local hands, and everybody breaks off into their groups. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that show is loaded in. Everything is hanging. The stage is in place. They're doing line checks, checking out the lighting equipment, getting ready for the band to come on and do a sound check. It is just really amazing technology how that's developed.
Even during normal times, now and then, a concert tour is, for any number of reasons, canceled. And an immediate result falls on the ticket office and Jeff Bojanowski and crew.
Probably the craziest was when Aerosmith, they actually started out postponing. And then the show eventually, after being postponed twice, eventually canceled. But we were just about to open the doors. We were just about to start letting people in the building. Show was set up. Everything was ready. And about 5 minutes before doors, I got a call that said, the show is not playing tonight. There you go. Be ready for people to come, because they'll be wanting their money and/or. And that was nuts. To have it so close to doors, to have it so close to showtime. We've had others that had postponed on the day of the event, but never one that was within, 2 hours of the event.
Do you have some sort of protocol in your hip pocket that you pull out and follow when something like that happens? And are the people that work with you, are they trained to deal with upset ticket holders?
You try to train them as best you can. You can never think of everything that a person's going to ask or everything that a person's going to demand. That was one where we really had to scramble, because this was quite a few years ago, so there were still a lot of people paying cash. And you immediately have to start looking to see how much cash you've got on hand and how to start giving refunds if people wanted their money back at that point and they had purchased from us. Then we had to start refunding immediately. So, we only had 5 to 10 minutes to get everything together to start. And you have to do it in such a way that you can obviously keep track of all the money. You can't just start, throwing money out the window. For something like that, we didn't have a set procedure at that point with so little time. You pretty much had to wing it. And I am blessed with having some great employees, great people that I work with that could handle it at the, basically at the drop of a hat. It's stop doing what you're doing, and now we're doing this.
There have been big changes in the technologies involved in arena concerts, and by big, I mean that literally. Bob Stoops.
When we first started in 76, most people were just ground supporting their gear. There were a few of the higher end bands that were coming in that might be hanging a couple of trusses. Nobody was hanging sound at that time. So when this building was built, we thought if you ever hung 40,000 pounds, you would be hanging a lot of weight. And now 140,000 pounds is not that much anymore. A lot of people are coming with that. I think Paul McCartney took a tour out, the heaviest one so far, that was like 192. So it's amazing the amount of weight that the venues have to support.
Over in the ticket office, Jeff Bojanowski also has a lot hanging over his head.
I think there's always been a perception that you just, put a set of tickets out there and there you go, you're off and running. But there's so much work that goes into prior to the sale, into getting the show built. All the nowadays, there's so much stuff that goes into a show. There's all the VIP offers and the meet and greet offers and the fan club offers and the pre-sales and so much. There's different codes for different things to give people access to be able to purchase. So there's a lot of work that goes into it. And then when it comes to the day of the show, there's so much work that goes into what we do. You know, we've got to make sure everything that we sold is right. Oftentimes the show will come in and they'll set up and you may have heard this from Bob, you know, it's a lot of work to set the show up. And sometimes the day of the show, they'll come in and go, oh yeah, we changed some things and we didn't tell you. So then you have to start looking at moving people, relocating people from one spot to another because suddenly they've made the stage bigger or they made the mix location bigger or they added cameras. Just recently when we did Sturgill Simpson on our show, they had us open some seats and then they forgot that they were actually filming the show. And then, you know, people start coming in and they're like, oh yeah, we forgot there's more cameras than we told you there were. Oops.
So those people were holding tickets, but there were no seats.
No, there were seats. They just couldn't see.
Oh, okay. The cameras were set up in front of them.
Right. Right. So, you know, you hope that doesn't happen, but you know, occasionally it does. And you have to be able to figure out what you're going to do with those people.
So I wondered, we've all been forced by the pandemic to slow down. And for many, that's providing time for a reflection about what's important and how this crisis is changing life as we know it.
There's a lot of information coming out there, a lot of speculation, a lot of questions.
Jeff Bojanowski.
Every state's going to be different. What one state's going to open up sooner than another state. So it's then going to be, when will tours actually be able to go out? When are they going to feel safe to put people on buses, to work all day with, I mean, some big shows, a Justin Timberlake or something like that would have a crew of over 100 on the road. You know, when are they going to feel safe? When are they? So it's really going to be hard to tell what's going to happen when it does start coming back. Are people going to feel safe to go back to shows? You know, there's a lot of talk that until there's actually a vaccine, a lot of people are going to stay away. Mm-hmm. But then there's the other side that says people have been missing live entertainment and sports as well for now months. People are going to be anxious to go back, but are they going to be able to afford to go back to events when they start happening? So hopefully, you know, you may see that maybe some of the ticket prices will come down to try to get people back. Maybe some of the artists will not want such high guarantees to play. Maybe there'll be some thought to, let's try to get the fans in. Let's give them a break. You don't know what's going to happen until it happens.
Bob Stoops.
There's been a lot of talk about what might be needed to move forward, but it still seems early to me to figure out what a lasting change is going to be. I do hope that one thing that's come to light for everyone, the public and everybody, realizes that, you know, the people that work in the touring industry, the roadies that come through that support the music acts, you know, they're like gig workers. They get paid while they're working. And when the tour stops, their paycheck stops. They don't have any benefits. It was nice to see the federal government recognized that and let them qualify for unemployment insurance. So I really hope a positive lasting change for our industry will be to see that the roadies and crews receive a better level of support in terms of health insurance, employment benefits, retirement contributions, et cetera.
Ask Bob Stoops and Jeff Bojanowski what's most rewarding about the work you do, and you get the same answer.
I think the people that I work with is the most rewarding thing.
Probably just the people that you get to work with, the people you get to meet.
But there's more.
And then probably the second thing, which is equally as important, is having been able to work at this venue, which is the home court for the University of Kentucky men's basketball team. That's been pretty special all these years, being around a program that's that good, that, you know, gold standard.
You know, sometimes you walk in and, you know, a sold out show, and you can just look around and go, wow, all these people were put there by our office. So it can be a good feeling to know that, wow, at least most of these people are happy, especially the ones right down front.
Rupp Arena Ticket Office Manager Jeff Bojanowski, and before him, Rupp Technical Services Manager Bob Stoops. Next week on Eastern Standard, in addition to part two of my interview with historian Carolyn Payton about the Maxey Flats nuclear waste dump near Moorhead, we put in a call to Pikeville, the Appalachian Center for the Arts, and its executive director, Robin Irwin, who only a year ago left Broadway for Eastern Kentucky.
Well, we came down here because we wanted a different way of life, a better, more quality of life.
We wanted to know how the pandemic is disrupting plans, operations, and life at the Center for the Arts.
It's unprecedented what we're facing, what all artists are facing, and all live entertainment and cultural gatherings. It's about that communal experience. And when all the authorities say, nope, you can't gather, then what do you do? How do you stay relevant? How do you still be seen as something essential?
Working alongside Robin as Director of Education and Outreach, another Broadway veteran, and her husband, Eric Buckley.
It's sort of like everything has been hit pause, and we all wait with bated breath.
We'll hear from Eric how the loss of the Arts Center's crowd-attracting productions ripple through the community.
Some of the hotels here count on Hillbilly Days sort of as their linchpin for their whole year, because literally in Hillbilly Days, you have to go two counties over to find a hotel room. The hotels for Hillbilly Days have been booked since October, and so that income is gone. All of the restaurants here, some of them set up outdoor booths. I know that there's an organization here that basically plans its entire year based on the income that gets generated by the Hillbilly Days.
Robin Irwin and Eric Buckley of the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville, among our guests on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.